So being a hobbyist, I like to read about other people who get off the craft. Yeah, in other traditions. So I find just reading about the insights of what I think are attained beings in other traditions quite interesting, because it kind of challenges like just someone coming from a whole different set of words, from a different model. And this, is that the same insight that I have? Or that I think this is the path? It's quite a nice challenge. So, I was just looking at my notes. I don't know, Meister St. John of the Cross, he has that famous ascent of Mount Carmel. To reach satisfaction in all, desire possession in nothing. To come to the knowledge of all, desire the knowledge of nothing. To come to possess all, desire the possession of nothing. To arrive at being all, desire to be nothing. I love those enigmas. I can't, you know, they really get it. So where's he coming from? Right. Now if I was a kind of dogmatic Buddhist, then I'd just sort of dismiss it all. He's, you know, he's Christian. But, you know, what's he seen? And I think that's a good challenge, because sometimes you can become, at least for me as a monk, because I live in such a, I live in a Buddhist bubble. Don't I just float around, except with mom. I just kind of float around this Buddhist world all the time. So I could become quite parochial in that sense, sort of caught up in my Buddhist view. So I think that's, when you read the dogmatic tradition, sure, I mean, some of these fundamentalists, whatever, I mean, they're awful, aren't they? It's really kind of terrible when you hear that kind of hatred that comes out of supposed religion. So then we tend to dismiss religion as being that. But then if you read the mystical traditions, you know, you read about beings who are coming from a whole different place. So, like, there's one Carmelite nun in California, and her definition of God is presence. Oh, so that's more interesting. You know, rather than some guy up there who's really hung up. So, okay. So I think that it's very easy to simply dismiss a tradition because of its negative side. So you can certainly find very superstitious Buddhists, you know, who when you look at, you know, the way they behave or something, you think, no thanks, I'm not going to touch that stuff. So a religious tradition is like in a Buddhist culture or a Christian culture, you're going to get all kinds of takes on it. Some are going to be transcendent, some are going to be very worldly, I think. I had a friend who died, but he had on his mantelpiece, he had four pictures. He had Ramakrishna, Mother Teresa, Ajahn Chah, and Sri Ramana Maharshi. And they were kind of three paths that he left to think about. So Ramakrishna, I don't know if you've heard of him, he died in the early 1900s. He was this fabulously eccentric Indian saint, whose path was bhakti, devotion. And it's the kind of saint that only India would allow to flower. I think in North America they'd give him Valium. Just damp him down. And it's just the most, you know, read about him, he's just the kind of most eccentric, fabulous kind of being who I totally don't understand. But I just found it really inspiring because of the devotion and just the, you know, it's because I love the craft to see someone so different. So there was Ramakrishna. So he's bhakti. He's the devotional path, the ecstatic. And so you find that in religious language. I guess Rumi is bhakti. He's an ecstatic, right? And if you read some of Rumi's language, you can see he's talking about, at least I see this, he's talking about awareness. If you don't understand Rumi, you think he's just getting drunk all the time. But actually, if you start to read him, what's he talking about? I get a sense that he's talking about awareness in a very a flowery way. Ours, Theravada, is the kind of driest tradition you can get. You know, it's like brain surgery without anesthesia. It looks like there's no bhajans or no whoopee. It's just at the coal face kind of hammering away. So Theravada is not for everyone, for sure. And then the second one on his shelf was Mother Teresa, and she's a karma yoga service. And one of the things I read about her, I know there's all the political things about her too, but what she was once complimented on the hospices and orphanages that she had set up for all these destitute people in India and all the world, really. And she said, well, I didn't set them up for them, I set it up for the nuns. Huh? And that's karma yoga. And it's where your life of service is so profound, it transcends ego. It has to be done right, huh? Karma yoga, oh. That's a nice way to look at it. And that really struck me, so it's for the nuns. Yeah, that makes sense. And then the other two, Sri Ramana and Ajahn Chah, the Jnani yogis, and they're the wisdom path. Sri Ramana, I don't know if you, he was famous for saying, I am that, no, that, that's the second one. Who am I? That, he died in 1950, South India. Anyway, a great saint who basically his path was, from what I've read, he was 17 years old. And he had this deep and profound question, who dies? And he just went into it, laid down, almost went into rigor mortis, and came out of enlightenment. And he had the most consistent life from then on, went down to Tiruvannamalai and became one of the great saints of India in the last century. And it's just this consistently moral life of very profound teaching for the rest of his life. He was about 75. And then Ajahn Chah, Jnani Yoga, is the path of wisdom, the path of insight. So that's what we're involved in. So the path of insight is seeing the profundity of awareness. You're realizing that there's something very, very profound about awareness, and that is the blessing of our human birth. That not only are we incarnate in physical bodies, and we have the animal instincts, and we have the possibility of being kind of very divine in our nature, or very, very, very hellish in our nature. We have all these different possibilities, but also we can reflect, we can be aware. And there's something quite magical about that. And so in our teaching in Theravada, it says, mindfulness is the gateway to the deathless. So there is this dimension which sometimes isn't really emphasized in the West, because I do, because I see that's kind of the niche I can fill, and that's the niche I enjoy in my hobby. But now, like, Buddhism comes into the West through Kabat-Zinn and mindfulness and stress reduction, which are very, very good things. But if it were just left to that, then it really wouldn't be the full offering that the Buddha is pointing the way to. But those things are good methods and good steps. And I don't think Kabat-Zinn would say that's all that there is in Buddhism. He would, no way he'd say that. He just very, very understood our culture, how to get these ideas of mindfulness into our culture. So that's such a gift to our culture. Let me just read this. I've always found this line inspiring. So this is from a teacher called Nisargadatta. The main change was in the mind. It became motionless and silent, responding quickly, but not perpetuating the response. Spontaneity became a way of life. The real became natural, and the natural became real. And above all, infant affection, love, dark and quiet, radiating in all directions, embracing all, making all interesting and beautiful, significant and auspicious. Wow. So that's a statement from a being who I suspect is enlightened. I can't say, you know. And so I've read a lot of his stuff. But so you get these reports coming in right? That there are dimensions of consciousness which are profoundly interesting, to say the least. And so, or you meet, like I had good fortune to be with Ajahn Chah, and you're with this man, and you said, I want to be like that. Whatever he's got, I want it. So then whatever he says, I'll do it. That's it. I would, you know, like, if he would have said, stand on your toes for 10 years, I probably would have done it. Fortunately, he didn't. But, you know, he had such a profound effect on me, that, it was motivation for a lifetime, really. So, there are these very special beings, and then there's you and I, kind of struggling on the cold face, right? But we can all be aware. You know, we all have that capacity. We can be aware of the way things are. And that's what we're trying to cultivate, this capacity to awaken to the way things are. Now, this does seem very nothing in the beginning, because there's no excitement in it, and there's nothing kind of riveting. And that's the difficulty with it. It doesn't seem like it's getting anywhere. But the idea is not to get anywhere. It's always to stay here. It's different. But as one begins to appreciate that the awareness of change is unconditioned, it's not a condition. It's a different kind of, can't even call it a thing. You begin to realize happiness in that very sense of being. And then the need for pleasure and the fear of pain, that changes completely. It's not that you reject pleasure. It's just the whole sense of that's the only thing there is. That there is only sense pleasure, and that there's no deeper kind of possibility of fulfillment. That changes, because you know there's a deeper space of fulfillment. And then pleasure is pleasure. Ice cream tastes like ice cream, right? And you bump your foot, you bump your foot. It's just the way it is. But the intensity around pleasure and pain changes a lot. And so there's a kind of joy in the heart to know that. And so you get enigmatic statements like Ajahn Buddhadasa says, oh, joy at last to know there's no happiness in this world. You get stuff like that. And you can only take that if you're on a kind of mystical path, a transcendent path. If you take it as like, you can't say that to everyone, really. It's just very deadbeat. So that brings me to this word dukkha. And dukkha is one of these words that is, again, it's very hard to translate. And dukkha it is a word that's mistranslated or misused. So the words from the Theravada tradition oftentimes are in different contexts. So like the word dharma is very hard to translate, because it's used in different ways in different contexts. The same with the word dukkha. So the word dukkha is used in three contexts. Dukkha vedana, dukkha saccha, dukkha lakkhana. So dukkha vedana, vedana is feeling. And dukkha here means unpleasant feeling. So when I fall on the ice and I whack my knee, that's dukkha vedana, right? And when I lay down after a hard afternoon on the cushion, and I take the body down, that's sukha, sukha, that's pleasant, right? So that's one way it's used. And that's biological and psychological. There's a biological need to know pain, right? And to know pleasure, right? If you didn't have pleasure, you would need to know pain, you would move away from it. And then psychological too. So that's one way, dukkha vedana, sukha vedana. Second way is dukkha saccha, and that is from the Four Noble Truths. And in the Four Noble Truths, there is suffering, there is the cause of suffering, there is the end of suffering, and there's the path that leads to the end of suffering. And suffering and dukkha here has a broad range. It can be from the most minor discontent to a major upheaval in consciousness. And that's the Four Noble Truths. And what the Four Noble Truths are trying to show us is that we all want to be happy, right? We want to be happy. And if if we are unhappy or we're suffering in some kind of way, and we don't understand that, the reason for that, the causality of that, and we just react in an ignorant way, then we'll just perpetuate suffering. So by looking at suffering, we answer the question we all have of happiness. Call it fulfillment, call it whatever you want, but that's a drive in us. It's a yearning in us. This is very, very natural. So if we don't answer that question, we remain ignorant. And so the way we talk about this is that we have to understand suffering. Now the way this got mistranslated was that Four Noble Truths is that the world is suffering. Alright, so it got mistranslated that everything is suffering as a kind of awful experience. So then like the early Christians painted Buddhism as a very nihilistic teaching. They didn't think about what enlightenment was and so on. It got painted in a very, very kind of negative way, to say the least. So in this context, there is suffering is an important statement because it's not, you want to make suffering a dharma rather than a personal problem. Whereas you take refuge in dharma. So if I'm sitting on a retreat and it's too hot, let's say, and you know, I'm feeling uncomfortable because it's too hot, and then my mind starts to complain, why did they open the windows? You know, or you know, how much does this heating cost for this place? It's a nice thought. And then you're then you wake up, this is suffering. Or this is discontent. Where is it? What does it feel like? You want to understand it, you want to come to it. And that's getting out of it's personal, like it's mine, it's not yours, but the whole sense of a person is you objectify, don't you? You begin to look, oh, discontent feels this way, or whatever it might be. And that's the understanding of dukkha. You awaken to that feeling of discontent. If I take it personally, that's attachment. And then that leads on to the cause, and the cause is attachment to craving. So attachment has to be understood, craving has to be understood. These are difficult words. And craving is always conjoined with ignorance in Buddhism. So we use the word tanha, and I think tanha is better than desire, because desire can mean good things too. And it's the abandonment of this attachment that is the end of suffering. So, I'm feeling hot, and I like cool, and I like the heat, and you know, getting restless, and looking at the clock, and then I wake up, so there's definitely dissatisfaction. What's the clock? Where is it? And I observe. And that's the beginning of non-attachment. And then I begin to see, I want it different. I want something I don't have. And I said, well, maybe I'll just feel the heat. What does it really feel like, heat? And I begin to let go of the craving, non-attachment. It's still hot. And I can get out of the room if I need to and so on. But I begin to touch just the way things are. It's just this way. It's just hot. And the rest is something I'm creating around them. And I begin to see what letting go is. And that the peace of the mind that comes from that. So, like with my thing around fear, I talk about this a lot, because I have so much from fear. The problem with the fear was not fear, it was the desire to not have the fear. That was the first problem. So it was the aversion to the fear, right? And that took a long time. And so because it was so unpleasant, there was more than heat in the room. Heat the body and everything else. So just struggling with that, okay, what's the problem? And I could not see that the problem was the aversion, the desire not to have. Once I began to see that, then I began to have affectionate attention towards the very feeling of fear, and then the fuel, which is attachment, began to burn away, and now I only get afraid in big occasions. Give me a big funeral, I'll panic. I just get so afraid of funerals. Anyway. So it still comes up, right? But that's just the way it is. It gets stimulated by, you know, more exaggerated kind of situations. But I know, this is just this feeling. So that understanding of attachment and letting go and craving is what we work with the Four Noble Truths. And each of us have a different pattern and so on, but that's the struggle that edifies. And the path is one to teach us how to cultivate the right factors for that. So that's dukkha satya. Dukkha lakkhana is characteristic. And lakkhana It comes from the Buddha's realization of enlightenment, okay? And the way he talked about that, he used the word nibbana or nirvana, which is a kind of hackneyed word now, kind of a cliche word. But also he used unconditioned, uncreated, unoriginated, unformed. So he realized something which wasn't mortal. Not an ego which lived forever, but something which wasn't dependent on causes and conditions. Which is a realization. And even to talk about it in that way is hard, because language is always dualistic. It's always conditioned and so on. So that, and he left it very enigmatic that way. He left it in a language that's very hard to decipher, deliberately. So then, anything which is conditioned is unsatisfactory in relation to the deathless, in relation to the unconditioned. And that's where you get the line, everything is dukkha. Everything is dukkha. All conditioned things are dukkha. Right? Now, if you translate that everything is suffering, it sounds like, you know, ice cream tastes like chalk. Well, it doesn't taste like ice cream. Or that, you know, then you get a kind of morbid kind of teaching where everything is suffering. But it's not what it's pointing to. It's pointing to the characteristic of pleasure and pain as being unsatisfactory in relation to his realization, in that sense. So if you put all your chips on pleasure, well, you're always going to be playing with pleasure, displeasure. And that's samsara. It just, you know, it's going from pain to pleasure, pain to pleasure. But he said there is an alternative. There's the alternative is that mindfulness is the path to the unconditioned, or the gateway to the deathless. Alright? That's difficult language. You know, it's not something that we're used to. So you have to really kind of ponder that and contemplate that. But what that actually does then is, you begin to have a different relationship to pleasure and pain. Pleasure is still pleasure, pain is still pain, but you begin to investigate like displeasure. Like I suggested with the lying meditation. You just feel like uncomfortable, rather trying to get comfortable all the time. You begin to find a way of being mindful of comfort and discomfort. You begin to be detached from those. They still feel the way they feel. But you can see it, if I'm not so dependent on pleasure and displeasure, and I begin to know them as change, my mind begins to function in a way which isn't just driven by conditions. I'm not just reacting to conditions anymore. There's the pleasure is pleasure, pain is pain. But behind that, there's this knowing. And I begin to be curious about the knowing or the awareness. So in awareness practice, we're no longer concerned about the conditions. We're more interested in the awareness of conditions. In pleasure, in the pursuit of pleasure, we're interested in the object. Beautiful art, beautiful music, beautiful people, beautiful weather, or blah, 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 blah. And we're attracted to that in whatever way, or harmonious societies, or you know, all kinds of ways. And so our attention is always on the objects. Pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain. Now, the teaching is saying, well, notice change. And that's another characteristic. That all conditioned things change. It's a lakkhana. It's a characteristic. That anything which is conditioned by other things is going to change. And you can't control it. You can put a little bit in, but you haven't got control. It's bigger than you, it's nature. So that's another condition, a lakkhana, is anicca. It's a condition that this clock is quite a pleasant bit of technology. Someone gave me, you know, a striving to enjoy it. But it's dukkha. Why is it dukkha? Because its characteristic is unsatisfactory, even though it gives me fun. Right? So if you mistake this, that it's suffering, you know, all the time I'm sitting here thinking of my clock and I'm suffering all the time. Right? That's not what the teaching's pointing to. If you stepped on it, then it would be suffering. You know, because I'm attached to it. Or that it's like the other idea, that it's changing. Well, if it stopped changing, then I'd suffer. Right? If you stepped on it and stopped changing. So change isn't just like the atoms. It's not that. No, no. That its relation to me is changing. And if I grasp any characteristic of it, then that grasping will eventually lead to suffering. Right? So, you have dukkha lakkhana, anicca lakkhana, and anatta lakkhana. Anatta is not self. And it's another one of those terribly difficult Buddhist concepts. And so you have this idea of not self, and that got translated that there's no self. Right? So you're sitting here, and your knees are hurting you, and I'm telling you there's no self. You said, bloody hell, it's on your knees. So there is something going on, and we're conscious in a body and so on. And the characteristic of not-self is trying to point to the fact that this whole sense of personal attachment to it is actually something that we need to investigate. And if we investigate it, we'll see that the sense of me being that is not true. Because like let's say, I am a fearful person. Right? I've got a lot of fear problems. I've really got to work through my fear. But is that true? Fear is something that arises according to cause and conditions. But am I always fearful? Not really. When I'm eating the ice cream, I'm not fearful. So is fear me, or is fear a condition that arises and ceases? So the idea of anatta lakkhana is to see that the characteristic of self is something that arises and ceases too. Like if I have a discussion with you and it's very harmonious and friendly, and I encourage you and your practice is going great, and then we have a discussion and God, your practice is down the tube, right? You haven't had a chance. Oh, we're having a chance, right? That sense of self arises dependent on causes and conditions. It's not permanent. Sometimes I feel elated, sometimes I feel confident. Elation and calm, they're not any essential self. There's something that arises according to causes and conditions. They can seem very essential, like they can seem very, very real, but you begin to see they're just objects. So the sense of self is a psychological entity that kind of arises according to the cause and then ceases again, doesn't it? In the silence between thoughts, is there any self? I say, viradhamma. What? I am here. This is silent. There's no being. This is silent. And how does the viradhamma get born in the world? Well, I have to say something, how's mom doing? No, you shouldn't have done anything. Thought going on. So anatta lakkhana is kind of trying to disentangle this wrong understanding, wrong view. So who are you then? And just to say there's nothing there, like this kind of absence, that's not true because there's you're feeling something. Well, one way to say, well, what is awareness? Make that your real home. Be Buddha knowing Dharma. Be awareness itself. And now that's an interesting challenge because usually you want to be a thing. You want to be a person. You want to be successful. You want to be happy. And now just be the awareness. Be the knowing. And that's what we refer to Buddha. So you feel some kind of self-doubt or anger and you want to fix it. I shouldn't be angry. And I should be more loving, or I need to read more books, this is the condition of doubt. It arises and ceases. That's anicca, dukkha, anatta. Confidence is anicca, dukkha, anatta. So you get this whole idea of beginning to see this movement of consciousness having three characteristics, and they're called the characteristics of existence, of being. And that which knows that, and can abide in that, that's the gateway. That's the path. To know change, rather than to always try to change. To be a knowing, rather than always to be caught in conditions. Now, it's not easy. You have to kind of ponder it quite a lot. But where the misunderstandings come, first of all, that there's no self. That's, you won't find that in the teaching. What you'll find is that that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease, and there's, in that there's no essential element of self. That's all. It doesn't say there's no self. It doesn't be a kind of nihilistic teaching. Now that may just seem like playing with words, but it is very important, because otherwise you just think there's nothing but this. It's just this awareness. There's awareness there. So anything that arises and ceases does so because of causes and conditions. So you have causality, impermanence, and because it arises and ceases, it's not the Buddha's point is something else, the unconditioned. So when you stop grasping the conditions and you abide as witness of, as awareness of Dharma, you begin to open the gateways to the deathless. And that's the pathway to enlightenment. And any time you miss that, you take these characteristics personally, or you grasp desire, or you seek objects, then you're in samsara. You're kind of wandering from birth to birth, going around and around. So when if someone asks you that everything is suffering, you have to put it in the right context. All things are conditioned, and that's that, in that sense the dukkha. But to say that the pleasant is unpleasant is not true. But the pleasant is not nibbana. Right? So none of us, you know, put all our eggs on ice cream. It'd be foolish, wouldn't it? Right? So the hard part of this is to bear, usually it's to bear with the unpleasant. But the unpleasant takes you to very deep states of, it has the kind of possibility of taking to very deep states of peace, because as soon as it's unpleasant, we seek the pleasant. Right? So to be with something uncomfortable and to know it is cutting into the whole craving process. And that's why meditation can be so hard sometimes, and you're just going to have very difficult things. Okay, that's a lot there.